Wait, parley for what? He won't let us leave.
Ryan, dear fellow, though your judgment is sound in most matters, meeting this man might be tantamount to pouring gasoline on a fire.
I agree. It's probably a trap.
Gotta be.
More than likely. That's why you're going with me. He might want to talk to me alone, but that doesn't mean I can't arrange for my own cover.
The six companions spent the next 2 hours cleaning and loading their weapons. A few minutes shy of noon, Autry came to the door.
It's time, Ryan.
When the others arose, his gaze narrowed.
I'm certain Hatchet Jack meant for you to go alone, Mr. Carter.
I'll talk to him alone, but I want my back covered.
There are guards at the pass.
With bows and arrows and maybe a muzzle loader. I think our firepower will more than complement your own.
Autry opened his mouth to voice an objection, then shut it and smiled in resignation.
As you wish. Come with me, all of you.
Most of the population of Amicus seemed to be lining the street as they marched toward the pass. None of them spoke or so much as smiled.
They're scared.
I don't blame them.
Not of the cadre. Of us. Of what we might bring down on them.
A blonde woman shouldered her way out of the row of onlookers. She was wearing a long, fringed dress of soft doeskin. It took Ryan a moment to recognize Felicity, with her hair combed, face clean, and wearing clothes. She fell into step beside him.
You're going to talk to Hatchet Jack?
Yeah.
Maybe you can ask him to return my husband's body.
Ryan knew that most of the tribes of the plains performed ceremonies for their honored dead, believing the rituals allowed their journey to the spirit world to be speedy and uneventful. Felicity evidently shared those beliefs.
I'll do what I can.
Felicity ducked her head and dropped back. A pair of men stood at the mouth of the cleft cut between the hills. One, leaning on a flintlock rifle, was a white man with a seamed, scarred face. The other was a very young Amerindian, an arrow already knocked into the string of his bow. Autry stopped at the pass, and the others entered, Ryan in the lead. The noonday sun filtered its rays through the clouds, playing with the colors of the gorge walls. Rock streaks of green melted into pale blues, which lightened into sandstone yellows. Ryan was reminded of the light he had seen in his dream. At the curve in the gorge, Ryan halted and slowly poked his head around. A lone man stood on the sandy ground, holding a rifle. Attached to the barrel was a scrap of dirty white linen. No one else was in sight.
All of you stay here.
Ryan then stepped around the bend in the gorge wall. Hatchet Jack didn't move. He watched his enemy's confident approach with no expression on his face. Ryan's gaze swept him up and down in a swift appraisal. He appeared to be about the same age and height as Ryan, but built along heavier, massive lines. Dark blonde hair flowed from beneath a feather-decorated slouch hat. A matted beard of the same hue clothed his face. His buckskin tunic and leggings were fringed and beaded with Indian finery. A polished powder horn hung by a strap from his right shoulder, and a long-handled tomahawk had been thrust in at his wide belt, beside a 14-inch bowie knife. A metal ring was attached to the belt, and from it dangled what looked at first glance to be a thatch of coarse black threads. Then Ryan saw the faint pink of a human scalp shining through the hairs.
You who I think you are, beauty?
Depends.
On what?
On who you are.
Name's Hatcher. John Jacob Hatcher. Though them that speaks to me at all calls me Hatchet Jack.
I'm Ryan Carter.
Seems like I've heard that name before.
Maybe. I get around. Speak your piece, Hatcher.
You have my property in your paws. I want it back.
Ryan hadn't expected that, and it took a great deal of effort to keep the surprise from showing on his face.
Property? You mean your windwag?
No, you one-eyed piece of shit. I mean the map you stole off of one of my men.
Ryan realized the twine and oilcloth-bound packet was still resting in his shirt pocket.
Assuming I have it, why is it so important to you?
My business.
Not the way I see it. If I do have it, it spoils of war. Law of Deathlands.
And I say it's mine, Caldor.
If it's so important to you, why did one of your piss-breathed underlings have it?
He weren't an underling. He was my cousin. Did you chill him?
Is it important?
Not particularly. He never was worth much more than a catfish choked to death on a sandbar. A man like you is different. I could let you in on the deal. Might be you'd be real helpful in this here undertaking I got in mind.
What undertaking is that?
Hand over the map and we'll talk about it.
We'll talk about it now or not at all. Maybe we can arrange a trade.
What kind of trade?
The body of the man your men murdered yesterday. Turn it over to me, and I might just consider giving you the map.
We dragged that maggot bait away! Fucking coyotes have probably already got it.
I guess we don't have anything more to discuss.
Oh! I tried. By God. You can't say I didn't.
Then, men rose from the floor of the gorge. In a thinly shaved fraction of a second, Ryan realized the mechanics of the trap. The pirates of the cadre had lain in shallow ditches dug in the ground, covering themselves with neutral-colored blankets. Someone else, Hatcher probably, had sprinkled sand over them. There were three men, about 10 feet behind Hatcher, all armed with oversized flintlock handguns. Before any of the pistols could spit fire and lead, Ryan took the first course of action that occurred to him. He lunged for Hatcher. Running into Hatchet Jack was like body-blocking a tree, but Ryan held on tight.
Get the fuck off me, you wanna... Oh, you just fucked up big time!
Close locked, the two men wrestled and struggled, staggering on wide-braced legs. Hatcher's arms encircled Ryan's body, and they tightened across his spine. The pirate struggled to gain the upper hand, and Ryan knew it would only be a matter of time.
You brought backup, you cocksucker!
You want to talk?
Ryan rolled with the punch, drawing the Sig Sauer as he fell toward the ground. One of the pirates fell backward. His chest caved in by the bone-shattering impact of the 9mm round. Ryan wasn't wasting time on Hatcher. Though the man was certainly dangerous, he had dropped his musket when Ryan jumped him. The third pirate, his face flushed with fury, eyes shining in outrage, aimed his gun and pulled the trigger. Ryan didn't waste time thanking his luck for the miss. He took aim and fired.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! I'm unarmed, Carter!
Ryan stood up, never pointing the Sig Sauer away from the man's forehead.
What makes you think I'd give a shit?
Hatchet Jack gaped at him. When he saw the promise of his death in that single blue eye, his shoulders sagged. As they did so, the strap of his powder horn slipped off. As it fell to the ground, Hatcher closed his hand around the loop of leather, and he swung it in an eye-blurring circle. The tip of the horn caught the baffled silencer and slapped the Sig Sauer out of Ryan's hand. Backing away, he shook his stinging fingers. If the horn had struck his hand, all the delicate bones would have probably been broken. That horn was full of more than just powder.
I'm gonna enjoy this, you son of a... God damn it!
Return fire came from the opening in the gorge behind Hatcher. More of the cadre pirates were firing muzzleloaders at Ryan's people to keep them pinned down. They couldn't shoot without risking their leader's life, and the companions couldn't shoot at Hatcher without taking the same gamble. Ryan leapt toward Hatcher. Ryan ducked, the horn hitting the rock wall. The lid popped off, letting out thick, dully gleaming chunks of metal. They caught the sun and sparkled. Hatcher looped the leather strap around Ryan's throat. Ryan tore at the garrote with his hands, but the pressure on his windpipe only increased. Blindly, Ryan fumbled for the handle of his 18-inch ponga sheathed at his hip. After two groping motions, his hand closed over the handle. Blood streamed from a stab wound high on Hatcher's left thigh, and the man's face was contorted in a mask of rage and pain. The pirate started to draw his own knife, then he froze, his eyes on something behind Ryan. He backpedaled, limping slightly. Ryan turned and saw Jack, JB, and Christy racing down the gorge, guns in hand. Hatcher began to run, expertly keeping Ryan between him and the guns of his friends.
You're dead, Caldor! You're so fucking dead!
Ryan, you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
JB! Jack! Let him go!
We couldn't get a clear shot from where we were.
He planned it that way.
What did he want, besides to chill you?
Hey, I found your gun.
Is it damaged?
Just a little scuffed. Looks like he gave it a real good wallop, though. What the hell did he hit this thing with?
Ryan bent and picked up the chunks of metal from the gorge floor. There were three of them, each about the size and thickness of a big man's thumb, and they felt as heavy as lead. All had fairly smooth surfaces. He turned the largest one over. The side was far brighter, rough-textured, the marks of a saw still upon it.
Huh. Gold.
The pieces measured perhaps 3 inches long and less than a quarter of an inch thick. He checked to make sure the oilcloth-wrapped packet was still in his shirt.
Huh. Now I think I'm getting it.
What do you mean?
He wanted this.
A map? To what and where?
I would imagine to more of this gold, but to where I have no idea. Maybe Mr. Autry will have an opinion or two.
They met Autry and the pair of guards before they reached the end of the pass. Their faces didn't register relief when they caught sight of the six people, alive and unharmed, but they didn't look disappointed either.
We heard shots.
Took long enough to make a wreck.
Hatchet Jack, is
he? No, but three of his crew are.
Did he want you to give yourselves up to him?
That subject wasn't raised.
Ryan opened his hand, showing the slices of gold. With the other hand, he gave Autry the map.
He wanted me to give this up instead. Jack found it on one of Spotted Hawk's killers.
Audrey's gaze flicked from the gold to the map, then back again.
This map is probably 250, maybe 300 years old. It was the cause of a lot of ugly history a few centuries ago.
Why?
Golden dreams and ugly realities. Let's get back to town and I'll tell you what I know.
Autry fetched a jug of a concoction he called White Mule and sat at the largest table in the tavern.
Have you ever heard of Coronado?
Francisco Vasquez Coronado? Provincial governor of Mexico and Texas, explorer, plunderer, and, some would say, genocidal monster.
Well, then you know more about him than I do. All I know are the legends, the campfire tales that have been passed down from generation to generation.
Let's hear them.
Over 600 years ago, during one of Coronado's expeditions, he heard about the seven cities of Cibola. These were supposed to be Native American treasure cities, scattered all over the West and Southwest. According to legend, they were so full of gold, silver, and precious gems that sunlight was reflected off them for miles around. Coronado and a company of conquistadors set out to find these cities.
There's a similar legend in Central America. Tales of the city of El Dorado have circulated for centuries.
At any rate, months passed, and the conquistadors were decimated by Indian attacks, disease, and exposure. Some believed Coronado traveled beyond the Yellowstone, deep into Utah. He found nothing and returned to Mexico a defeated man. However, the legend of the seven cities persisted, due mainly to one of Coronado's soldiers who'd committed their route to paper. According to the soldiers, they had indeed found the location of one of the cities, but they were driven back by an army of Indians before they laid eyes on it. During the early days of colonization of this territory, the map and the story wouldn't have been given any credence whatsoever if some of the Sioux groups hadn't enjoyed visiting the Franciscan missions, flaunting ornaments fashioned from gold and silver. In the mid-1700s, French explorer de Varenne chanced upon the map while staying at a mission near the Sweetwater River. He made a copy of the map, in French, of course, and went to New Orleans, intent on gathering men and materials to mount a major expedition. As the story goes, the man died, and the map was thought to be lost.
What happened to the original copy, the one in the mission?
The Indian chief Crazy Horse burned down the mission in the 1870s. It was probably destroyed.
Like you said, campfire stories.
Perhaps. But your map is obviously very old. It may be a copy of de Varenne's copy, but it definitely shows the route from the Yellowstone across the Washakie Basin, where we are, toward the mountains that can only be the Wind River Range.
If you've identified the landmarks, then why are the mountains labeled Mountains of Mystery?
Aside from the stories about the seven cities of Cibola, there are old Indian legends about hidden places in the Wind River and Medicine Bow Range. Medicine spots, they're called. Doorways to the other side. If these power points, these doorways, are sealed off, Indians believe their souls will wander for eternity. In these hidden places, in valleys and mountain peaks, dwell the ghosts of the first people, the prehuman ancestors of the Indian.
and rich veins of gold are also supposed to be there. To this day, some of the Lakota and Cheyenne wear gold ornaments and trade them here for goods. What you have there doesn't look like raw stream-panned ore. Looks to me like it was hacked from a molded ingot.
Revolving a piece of the gold between thumb and forefinger, Ryan realized he was right. The chunk of metal had been melted, worked, and formed sometime in the past. Though gold wasn't sought after as a rare commodity in some regions of Deathlands, in most of the baronies of the West, it was still prized and valuable enough to kill for.
You figure Hatchet Jack thinks one of these seven cities is in the Wind River Range?
Seems likely. If he could find it, he could set up the most powerful barony in this part of the country.
Is that not a delightful prospect?
I wonder where he got that gold. I probably traded or stole or chilled to get the map, but where'd he find the gold?
Probably tortured or chilled some poor Indian. Ryan, this red cadre is a bad bunch. About as bad as we've ever seen.
Ryan motioned to the gold pieces and the map.
And we've got four things he wants.
Five? Your scalp.
By late afternoon, the guards at the pass had reported no suspicious activity among the red cadre, but no one in Amicus seemed relieved. The settlement was unusually quiet. Every door, teepee flap, and shutter was closed, and there wasn't a sign or sound of movement from the interiors. Jack and Doc, walking down the street, were made uneasy by the hush. Though neither was familiar with the habits of Amicans, they were fairly well-versed in Vils, and the absence of children, men and women, stirred their hackles. As the only single members of the group of travelers, Doc and Jack were accustomed to giving Christy and Ryan and Mildred and JB some privacy whenever they sensed it was necessary. It was sometimes inconvenient to make themselves scarce, but they understood the need for couples to be alone from time to time.
Think the people moved out?
No, my dear Jack. According to Mr. Autry, the rear exit is really no exit from danger, since it simply leads to the plains.
Wait, you hear that?
Why, that sounds like more people than we've seen during this whole walk.
They in the bar.
Inside the saloon, there were about 20 people, fairly evenly divided between men and women. The few who noticed Jack and Doc's entrance shot them cold glances and went back to their discussions. One burly, soot-faced, stump-legged and stump-toothed man talked the loudest. He held court at a corner table, gripping a mug in one hand and a jug in the other.
Shit! Me and John Hatcher go way back. Used to hunt buffalo with him on the Washakie Divide. Saved his life when a chem storm came up.
Is he as bloodthirsty as his rep makes him out to be, Eli? Can he be reasoned with?
Well, he's a lusty infant, no denying that. But he ain't unreasonable. Just don't cross him.
Eli's gaze settled on Jack and Doc.
Like some donkey shit dumbass outlanders I recently heard about.
Why, that...
Ignore him, lad. He's simply passing wind in the frontier fashion.
They walked to the bar. The tavern keeper, Micah, was perspiring heavily, and sweat dripped from the ends of his mustache.
Wipe you.
If that is all you have on the list.
It is. So, you and your group staying or going?
We have yet to decide.
The man tried to grin, exposing brown speckled teeth.
Yeah, like the rest of these souls. Don't know if they want to light out for points east or stay and see what the cadre is going to do. Right now, they're letting the corn make up their minds.
Jack looked around him, and his nostrils detected an odor he hadn't noticed upon entering. Mixed in with the other aromas of the tavern was a faint but pungent smell. Jack had scented it many times before. The smell of desperation, of fear, of confusion. The eyes of the people mirrored it, and it shone there brightly, not in the least dimmed by the liquor they poured down their throats. Jack understood and sympathized with their confusion. The Amicans were faced with making a decision that could alter, even end, their lives. The citizens knew, without really knowing, that if they threw themselves into a fray against the Red Cadre, it would be a far more serious scrape than a backstreet brawl. And they also knew that even if they drank themselves into oblivion, they would still be there when the jugs ran dry, to run and live, or fight and die. It was a choice Jack had faced more than once during his short life. A gentle hand touched Doc's shoulder from behind. He turned to see Felicity standing there, her hair pulled back severely from her face.
Excuse me, Dr. Tanner, but I never heard. Did Mr. Carter ask Hatchet Jack about my husband?
A little jolt of pain went through Doc's heart when he looked into those blue eyes.
I am truly sorry, madam. Mr. Hatcher was unmoved by the plight of your husband's remains.
I expected him to be.
With a swirl of her doeskin skirt, she spun and left the tavern. Staring after her, Doc felt the pain within him transform into anger. It was the same anger he felt toward the scientists of Operation Kronos, who had wrenched him from his wife, Emily, and two children, Rachel and Julian. His constant pleas to be returned to his own era, to his family, had fallen on uncaring ears. To the scientists, he was only a test subject, and his emotional agony meant less than a sparrow's tears to the success of the time-trolling experiments. The scientists had justified their cold-hearted practices by claiming patriotism as a motive, since they were ensuring the safety of the United States against all aggressors. They had told Doc that, as an American citizen, albeit one from 1895, he should share their motivations. The old proverb, "patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel," was never more descriptive of anybody in history than the overseers of Operation Kronos. Doc wasn't the least ashamed of the satisfaction he felt whenever he remembered how all of the scientists had perished in the nuke cost. Appeals to patriotism and advanced technology had not saved them, but the latter, misused as it was, had saved him.
Damn, you hear that outside?
Hear what?
Acrid smoke rolled into the tavern as people recovered from the rumbling.
What in blazes?
Come on, Doc.
Jack and Doc went outside. The wall facing the pass was blackened and chewed up by shrapnel, and a pumpkin-sized crater smoldered a scant 5 feet from the clabbered siding.
Fad close.
Ryan, Christy, Mildred, and JB jogged from the hostel. When they spied Doc and Jack, they slowed their pace.
Grand, almost direct hit.
You see anybody out there?
No.
About 400 yards, I reckon. Whoever aimed the launcher had a decent eye.
How the hell was he able to put men on top of the hill without raising an alarm?
Interesting question. Let's take a wreck.
The six companions followed the street toward the pass. Mose Autry met them at the opening, waving at them to halt.
I called for the guards. Nobody answered.
How many on duty?
The same as before. Two?
Two? With those scumbags creeping around outside of town, you only posted two guards?
The cadre has made no direct threats against us, have they? Their quarrel isn't with us.
Ryan pushed past Autry and indicated with sign language that he, Christy, and Jack would climb the left-hand slope, while the other three scaled the one on the right. As was customary, Ryan took the point. Clouds, low and heavy, scudded across the afternoon sky. They were too thin to bring rain, but they cast shifting shadows over the rocky hillside. When Ryan cautiously topped the crest and looked out on the plain below, the first thing he saw was the bodies of the two guards. They lay about 100 yards beyond the mouth of the pass. Naked, they were staked to the ground in spread-eagled positions. Their faces, or what could be seen of them, were livid with blood. Ryan figured that their tongues had been cut out, or their throats cut. Perhaps both. John Hatcher and four of his pirates stood 100 yards beyond the mutilated bodies. He cradled the grin launcher in his arms, and when he saw Ryan top the rise, he lifted the weapon over his head. The pirates were just outside of range for Ryan. To fire at them would be a waste of ammunition. Ryan fixed his eye on the giant form of Hatchet Jack, and a fury swelled within him, the homicidal rage that made his heart and temples pound. Up until that moment, Hatchet Jack and the Red Cadre were problems of a tactical nature, not personal. Now, they had become enemies to be destroyed. That night, fires flared in the streets of Amicus. The faces of the people were bathed in flickering light, and red pinpoints gleamed from the many pairs of frightened eyes fixed upon Autry and Ryan.
Now, we're in a predicament. But Amicus has been in a number of them during its short history.
Nothing like this. Not even when the Sioux had hairs up their asses did they bottle up the town this way.
That's right, goddammit.
Yeah! Inasmuch as we're a democracy, I'm soliciting your opinions on our best course of action.
Well, I think we should give up right now.
Let's get out of here.
Let's go. Let's get over the back.
No, no. Even if we could skulk out of here, and if the cadre indeed harbors inimical feelings toward us, they could easily track us and catch us out in the open.
And if we stay here, we'll die pinned up like groundhogs.
The Amicans went into criticisms of personal habits and snared themselves in their own arguments. They would switch sides or even forget on whose behalf they were speaking. Finally, when hands clutched at weapons, Rand realized that Autry had lost control of the democratic process, so he stood up beside him.
Hey! Everybody shut up and listen! This place is defensible. If the cadre mounts a siege, we'll be able to hit them hard every time they stage an attack.
Hey! It's your scalp, Hatchetjack, once, Outlander. I think we ought to just turn you over to him, all dressed out and gift-wrapped.
Oh, don't give me that, boy, you goddamn fool! Hatcher wouldn't spare us now, no matter what we do to appease him. It's a matter of principle, of pride. His ego won't allow us to live.
What do you want us to do?
All I want is for you to do something that might save your skins and the Vill. God knows you've been leaving that responsibility up to others long enough.
Oh, I ain't gonna die because of some Outlanders. Ain't no need to.
Who's asking you to die? If you can't see the real threat, you'll die with us, Outlanders, not because of us. That's the bastard truth.
Felicity suddenly stepped into the firelight.
My husband, you all knew him, was murdered by the cadre for no other reason than they wanted to murder someone. And Spotted Hawk was close at hand. And it's funny, since we came to Amicus 3 years ago, so we wouldn't always have to be looking backward to see who was going to shove a blade into us. A lot of us came here to get away from enforced slavery to some fat-ass baron. We came here to live free. We wanted freedom from jack grubbing, from chilling another poor bastard so someone could take what he had. Freedom from stinking buzzard turds who live only so they can inflict pain on others. You pay for freedom, I guess. Maybe our lives are the price. Spotted Hawk used to say, the dead will live forever if they die inside a circle. I never knew what he meant. But now I do. Amicus, our community, the place we built, is a circle. I hope you know that before it's too late to do you any good. But I'd rather die than live and eat the shit Hatchetjack wants to shove down our throats. And unless all of you have acquired a taste for it, you'll stand with me and the Outlanders!
Felicity took another step and stood shoulder to shoulder between Christie and Ryan.
Ain't that inspiring? Well, I ain't joining up with no shirt-tail army. I know Hatcher, and I know he's a reasonable man.
Well, Eli, you're plenty free to ride out and strike your own deal if you've a mind to.
Think I won't? You're wrong. I'll go for a gab. And if I can't talk Jack into leaving us alone in exchange for Cyclops here, I'll kiss old Haslick's ass. Well, who go with me and prove this Outland blowhard wrong? Well, fine. I'll be back before the moon sets. Or maybe I won't. Maybe I'll come to my senses and join up with the cadre. I can do without you mush-minded fools.
Watching him stride away, Haslick edged out of the crowd and over to Ryan.
No offense, Mr. Carter, but I hope my ass ends up getting kissed.
As much as I hate to take anything Eli says seriously, perhaps we should wait and find out if his talk with the cadre bears any fruit.
Don't be stupid. Would you believe anything either one of them might say?
If nothing else, Eli might be able to give us an idea of the cadre's firepower and actual numbers. If he doesn't return by the time he's set, we'll begin making definite preparations.
Preparations for what? For a siege? A surrender? A flight or a fight?
I don't know.
Right. Well, let's take a look at this pass. See what it would take to barricade it.
Ryan, Doc, Haslick, and Felicity all walk toward the hills.
Felicity?
Hmm?
That stuff about dying in a circle, is that a common Cheyenne saying?
I don't know. It was something Spotted Hawk used to say. He said there is a life circle, and that it must not be broken. That there are some things worth dying for, and more importantly, worth living for. Why do you ask?
No reason. Haslick had provided the arms to the guards. When they reached the pass, he inspected each one, making sure that the weapons were being given the proper care and attention.
Shall hokey.
Good. Any of you see any movement?
Nah, nothing. Not within 100 yards.
Anything past that?
There's a campfire way far away. And we're keeping an eye on that fire to see if there's anything coming this way. We saw what happened to those other two guards, and that was during broad daylight.
At the narrow mouth of the gorge, Ryan eyed the dark plain. In the distance, at least half a mile away, was a flickering spear point of firelight. It was the camp of the Red Cadre.
Ain't kidding it, Mr. Carter. I don't fancy being hemmed up in here by prairie pirates.
Haslick moved away to rejoin the guards.
Ryan?
Yeah, Doc?
Has it occurred to you that we six could easily appropriate mounts from the corral and ride into the night? The Crimson Fraternity may follow us and leave Amicus unmolested.
It's occurred to me, but I doubt Hatch would bypass Amicus to get on our trail. He'd suspect they helped us to escape. He owes Amicus a serious bloodletting anyway.
Then I submit a variation to that same scenario. We simply ride into the night, leaving Amicus and Hatcher to settle their scores their own way.
Huh. I remember one time Trader found a stockpile of nerve gas on an old military base. Nasty stuff. Still potent. A whole lot of it, too, since it didn't get used during the nuking. Trader had customers for it. Serious Jack. But he disguised the site so no one, not even him, could make a profit from it.
The point being?
Trader accepted the responsibility. He took the responsibility for uncovering it, and he took the responsibility for covering it up again. There were some things that even he felt were too fucking foul to set loose on the world again, no matter how much Jack he could put in his pockets.
And you feel we should take responsibility for leading the cadre to Amicus?
You don't agree?
Oh no, I entirely agree. I was just interested in hearing you say it, since you are normally so taciturn when your emotions are involved.
What the... What are they doing? Serenading us?
No. They're sending us a message. That's the Degueo.
The what?
The Degueo. The throat-cutting song. A perennial of Mexican army regimental bands a few 100 years ago. Very old, dating back to the bloody wars between Spain and the Moors. When Generalissimo Santa Anna had the Texans boxed up within the Alamo, his bands played it on the night and morning preceding the final assault.
Hmm. No quarter. No mercy for the loser.
Ryan, rider coming in. Looks like Eli.
Haslick and the guards joined them at the edge of the pass. A rider was coming across the plain, but the horse was walking.
Well, what's wrong with the fool? Why is he meandering like that?
Perhaps he's hurt.
Or drunk.
Haslick, come with me.
Yeah, I'm coming too.
Fine. Keep your weapons hot.
Ryan drew his Sig Sauer, and bidding the guard and Haslick to follow him, sprinted out of the gorge. All of them stopped dead in their tracks when they came to within 20 feet of the mounted man. They walked the remaining distance. There was no need to hurry. Eli was bound to his saddle by a wooden A-frame that held him upright. His face, drained of all color save for a smear of blood, was twisted in a rictus of terror and pain. The blood had streamed from the top of his head, where his scalp had been before it had been shorn away. His chest bore a narrow, gaping wound that had obviously been made by the blade of a broad-headed hatchet. Pinned to the front of his coat with a sharpened bone needle was a square of paper. Scrawled on the paper, no doubt in Eli's own blood, was a single word. Soon.
Autry, get up!
Mr. Cawdor, what's the meaning of...
The Cadre's going to strike at first light. We gotta be ready.
What? How do you know?
Ed came back from trying to talk to Hatchet Jack. Hatcher kept his scalp.
But why would Hatcher warn us like this?
Ego, like you said. Also to shake us up, scare us so we can't think clearly. Right now, we'll concentrate on defense. When that's done, we'll map out an offensive strategy.
You think either one will do us any good against all of them?
Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But we can't sit here all night waiting to die at dawn.
I suppose so.
You suppose so? What the hell is that? Autry, you're the leader here.
They blame me for this. By offering you and your people refuge, I dragged them into this predicament.
You can let them think you can drag them out of it.
I'm tired, Cawdor. Tired of fighting for lost causes. That's all Amicus is, you know. Another lost, empty dream. And Deathlands won't suffer dreams to live. I should have known.
No, I'm not going to stand here and listen to this bullshit. I know about lost dreams, believe me. I also know it's not always possible or even desirable to fight on the winning side. Maybe the buzzards will end up making dinner out of our carcasses, but we can make sure we won't be the only course.
You've got the gift of finding hope in hopeless situations, Mr. Cawdor. Maybe some of that gift will rub off on me, and I can pass it on to my people.
Well, first, you get to pass the news to your people. My companions are gathering them at the tavern.
All of the weapons in town were brought to the tavern. Most of them were Haslick's muzzleloaders, rifles and pistols. Everyone had knives, many of which were homemade replicas of Bowie's famous blade. A few possessed tomahawks, and there were plenty of bows and arrows. Haslick had powder and shot in his workshop, but it was barely enough for a protracted battle. As Haslick had indicated, there was an AK-47 in town.
Let's take a look at this baby. Bah, firing pin's busted. Might make someone a piss-poor club, though.
Autry took a group of men and women to the mouth of the pass and set them to work building a barricade of rock, linking the largest boulders by chest-high walls of sandstone and shale that would serve as adequate battlements for the defenders. The defenders themselves consisted of 36 people, 19 men and 17 women, none under the age of 15 or over the age of 50. All of them had lived many years on the frontier, and Ryan saw no need to drill them. The rest of the citizens were either too old, too young, too infirm, or not inclined to take part. They were confined to hastily erected shelters near the boneyard. The night wore on, with Autry and Ryan supervising the Amican's appointed tasks. The hills on either side of the pass worried him more than he let on. Barricade or no barricade, he knew that the Red Cadre would split its force, some sweeping through the gorge and others scaling the hills. There weren't enough people to defend both hills and the pass.
Hey, Ryan?
Yeah?
You know, with that Gren launcher of his, Hatcher could stand out on the plain and pepper the town to pieces.
I know, but he'll be firing blind. We'll have blasters on the hilltops to keep them from climbing. They'll have to come through the pass.
Yeah. If there was only some way to bring the walls down when they're jammed in the gorge.
Mr. Cawdor!
Felicity jogged up to them, a rifle cradled in her arms. She wore a brace of flintlock weapons and a sash at her waist, as well as a long-bladed knife.
I need to ask you something.
What?
No matter what happens, Hatchet Jack will be coming after you, right?
I'm counting on it.
If you can, will you spare his life?
Why?
So I can have it.
Revenge for your husband?
No, not revenge. A reckoning of the spirits. It has to be done, or Spotted Hawk's spirit will never rest.
I can't promise anything. I'll do what's necessary, even if that includes killing him before you get to him.
Felicity's lips compressed, and she turned and walked away. Ryan shook his head in bewilderment.
I never heard of that spirit-balancing belief before.
It's not too different from balancing Gaia's earth energies. They've got to be maintained on a certain level, or one side will tip and cause a negative or positive power avalanche.
Avalanche? That's it.
Huh?
Come on!
Taking Christy by the arm, Ryan rushed back into the ville, fetching Doc, JB, Mildred, and Jack along the way. The companions scoured the town for every jug, empty, full, or otherwise, that they could find. Micah was out building fortifications and wasn't able to object when they poured the acrid contents of some of the jugs onto the ground. They joined the others outside Haslick's workshop and examined the 10 one-gallon jugs for punctures or cracks. All of them were whole.
So, we using these jugs for anything?
Yeah. Haslick said he had some gunpowder in his workshop. We fill these jugs with gunpowder, then drill holes in the corks. A fuse can be run from each of these jugs and braided and linked to make one long fuse. You think the bang will be big enough to drop the sides of the gorge down on the heads of the cadre?
How much gunpowder does he have?
About 2 kegs.
If the powder is of halfway decent burn quality, yeah. If it isn't, we'll just have a fizzle and no way to retrieve the powder unless Hatcher finds it and uses it himself against us.
That's a chance we'll have to take.
Haslick had the proper material for a fuse in the workshop, and Jack and Doc set to work, puncturing the corks of the jugs with knives. Mildred and JB, with the use of a funnel, carefully poured the gunpowder into the jugs. Ryan and Christy busied themselves partially unbraiding the long loop of fuse, sprinkling powder along its length, then entwining it again. When the jugs were filled and the corks punctured, Ryan bound the containers together with rope so if one detonated prematurely, the others wouldn't be hurled away by the explosion.
That should be good. It's almost dawn. Christy, you want to help me out?
I suppose so.
The climb to the top of the right-hand hill was rugged, with Ryan weighed down by the jugs of gunpowder. He was sweating hard by the time they reached their destination. There were a few tangled mesquite bushes at the crest, as well as patches of wildflowers with drooping petals. Not stopping to rest, Ryan examined the lip of the ridge overhanging the gorge for cracks or faults. He found a deep split in the strata, 7 steps from the edge. It was 3 feet deep and 15 feet long. He and Christy inserted the loose tendrils of fuse into the holes in the corks. When the job was finished, Ryan stood and ran out the fuse, tossing it down the face of the hill. The powder-impregnated line wasn't long enough to reach the barricades, so when the time came, someone, probably him, was going to have to expose himself and climb 50-odd feet to light it. The sun was a bare finger's width above the horizon when they began to arrive. The windwags of the Red Cadre swept across the plain. They rolled in a compact, orderly formation from 2 different directions. A few hundred yards from the pass, the pirates disembarked. Ryan had expected a disorganized mass, like spooked cattle, but the men marched in ordered ranks. Ryan stood atop the right-hand hill with Christy and Jack. 6 men stood behind them. On the left-hand hill were 6 men, all identically armed with long rifles. Mose Autry stood with them. Mildred, Doc, and JB were at the fortifications below.
There's more of them than I thought. Maybe 200.
Ryan peered through the binoculars and saw well-built men with faces devoid of warmth or humor. Most of them carried muzzle loaders, but he spotted a few multi-shot guns here and there among them.
No, more like 50. The manner they march in is an old Indian trick, to make the enemy think he's hopelessly outnumbered.
John Hatcher brought up the rear. On his belt was a new scalp, the color of Eli's hair. He cradled the M79 Gren launcher, and a bag hung from one shoulder. It looked heavy, and Ryan figured it contained the explosive rounds. A man walked beside him, holding a battered, verdigris-eaten green bugle.
All right, everybody. Remember what we planned. Pick your targets and fire. While you reload, me and my people will blaze away.
Ryan glanced at Christy. She had her Smith & Wesson in both hands, and she gave him a reassuring smile. He propped the cushioned stock of the Steyr against his right hip. The pirates thundered across the plain, moving as though they were being pushed forward by a wind from Death's Kingdom.
Everyone hold your fire! We'd just be wasting shots! Ready? Fire! Reload!
Ryan, do you have a beat on Hatcher?
No! There's too many out there!
So let's thin the herd!
Ready! Fire!
Ha! This is like shooting fish in a barrel!
Now this is hardly the time for boasting!
Yeah, it is! Look! They're retreating!
Sure enough, the pirates wavered, turned, then raced back toward their windwags. 7 of them would never sail the prairie again. Yeah!
They were testing us. Won't turn them back easy next time.
What are they up to now, Ryan?
It looks like Hatchet Jack's giving them a pep speech. He doesn't look too happy.
Ryan continued to watch the activity through the binoculars. The cadre milled around their wags, and he saw several clamber aboard each one, Hatcher included. With a series of lurches, the fleet rolled forward. The wags were maneuvered closely together until a gap of only 6 or 7 feet separated the holes. The pirates were crouched between the curving sides of the craft, snug on the inside of the formation. The remainder marched behind. Almost every man was protected by mobile cover. It was a strategy Ryan had expected and feared. The first sortie had been experimental, testing their defenses and the quality of their marksmanship. Hatcher hadn't wanted to risk damage to his craft unless it was absolutely necessary. Apparently, he now considered the risk necessary. The engines that powered the fan blades, which in turn filled the sails, were protected by sheet metal cowlings. The balls fired by the muzzle loaders didn't have the velocity to penetrate the sheathing. Even shooting the sails full of holes would only slow the advance, not halt it.
Eyes on your targets!
Ryan raised the Steyr to his shoulder, fixing one of the pilots in the scope's crosshairs. He waited until the man's head, shoulders, and torso filled the sight. Though the light was growing stronger, the Starlight scope's laser image enhancer was still useful. A hail of bullets smote the windwags, splintering handrails, tearing gouges in the woodwork, and puncturing sails.
Good shots!
Shifting the sights of the Steyr to a center wag, he saw Hatcher appear on the deck. A ferocious grin split the man's bearded face, and Ryan's finger tightened on the trigger. At the same instant, Hatcher brought up the M79.
Everybody down! Move!
Grin had fallen short, impacting explosively against the face of the hillside. Still, the concussion shook the ground and gouted dirt, turf, and gravel in all directions. A cloud of smoke, dust, and pulverized rock particles hung in the air like a veil of soiled chiffon.
He's close enough to make him count! Fall back! Everybody, fall back!
Ryan had just enough time to see the smoke trace an arc heading right for him. The Grin landed, no more than 3 feet away. A battering ram of hot, almost solid air slammed Ryan off the top of the hill.
Ryan!
Ryan, take my hand.
Ryan looked up to the top of the hill. Twisted smoke rose, and he saw the sparse grass was covered with a glistening crimson dew.
Christy!
Let me go!
Ryan! Stop fighting us!
Christy, Jack, and two of the riflemen appeared on the crest of the hill. All four people were dawed and streaked with blood, but they appeared uninjured, though Jack was favoring his right leg. They scrambled down the hillside.
The blood isn't mine, Ryan. I was standing behind the man it belongs to.
Mildred ran exploratory fingers up and down Jack's leg.
Chunk of rack hit me.
Well, I don't think any bones are broken, but I imagine you'll have a hell of a bruise.
The blast sent bodies as limp as ragdolls flailing into the air, rending them apart with shrapnel and shockwaves. The detonation bit a sizable portion out of the hill and spit it skyward. A body came tumbling down the face of the hill, and JB broke from the cover of the barricade and ran toward it. Before the corpse rolled all the way to the bottom, it reached down a bloody hand and grasped a handful of tough grass to stop the tumble.
Oh, no.
JB ran up the slope and grabbed Moe's Autry.
Autry! Autry! Look at me!
The man's eyes were unfocused and glassy. Blood trickled from lacerations on his arms and legs, and from his ears. JB grasped Autry's wrists, stooped, and wrestled him over his shoulder in a fireman's carry.
You're concussed. Stay limp. You're gonna have to hold off on all that bacon after we're through with this, Autry.
As he sprinted back toward the fortifications, JB saw that the cadre was pushing through the gorge and climbing the hills. Retrieving the Steyr, Ryan joined his friends behind the makeshift battlements just as a pack of pirates appeared at the mouth of the pass. No one needed to give the defenders at the walls an order. At that range, every ball found a target. But the men of the Red Cadre managed to return more than just random fire. One of the defenders suddenly jerked, hands over his belly, crimson squirting between his fingers.
They're trying to retreat! Fire! Hold your fire!
Everyone continued to glance toward the hilltops for any sign of Hatchet Jack or a Grin. The stretch of ground between the battlements and the pass was carpeted with bodies, some trying to move, most motionless and leaking fluids. Smoke drifted in flat planes over them. The companions quickly reloaded their weapons. Ryan glanced around, and JB, Mildred, Jack, Doc, and Christy all met his gaze with self-assured nods. A small dark object rocketed out of the cleft between the hills and struck the barricade broadside. Gobs of torn, blood-slick flesh hit the ground, and a red mist mingled with the dust and smoke. Just then, the Red Cadre boiled out of the gorge. But the wall hadn't collapsed under the concussive force of the Gren, as Hatcher had evidently hoped. The men leading the charge hesitated, slowing their pace. The marauders behind them kept coming, throwing the first wave headlong against the rock barricades. Men fell, were dashed against the jagged bulwark, but they still kept coming. Like a tide, the howling horde flooded over the half-toppled battlements. The Amakans met the cadre with knives, tomahawks, and clubbing blaster stocks. Along the line of stone was bloody chaos. Hatchets chopped, knives broke on rock, skulls were split with gun butts. The Amakans fought with the fury of desperation. They hacked, slashed, bludgeoned, and died. Ryan, half blinded by dust and black powder smoke, glimpsed Micah go down with a tomahawk buried in the crown of his head. He saw one of the cadre rush toward Mildred, who had her back turned.
Oh, no you don't.
The marauder flopped face down, a geyser of scarlet pumping from a cavity in the side of his head. Ryan fell under a pirate and saw a knife blade thrust for his throat. Ryan dodged, and the blade broke against the ground. Ryan brought his Sig Sauer up. Elbowing aside the corpse, he leapt to his feet. It was JB's Uzi that tipped the scales. The diminutive armorer squeezed off three-round burst after three-round burst, and at that range, he didn't miss a single target. Nor did any of the targets survive the pounding hail of 9mm stingers. The cadre engaged in a slow, stubborn retreat, climbing over the barricade and backing away toward the gorge. Their covering fire was ragged and sporadic. No one cheered the rout. There were too many dead and too many wounded inside the fortifications. Ryan went to Christy, who was bleeding from a wound in her right arm. He didn't have the opportunity to check on the rest of his friends. Mose Autry forced himself through the dust and smoke and came to his side. His lower torso was sodden with blood, and he held a scarf over the knife slash across his belly.
Oh, we're done. It's over. Almost no ammunition left. Dead and wounded everywhere. All Hatcher has to do is fire one more Gren.
Ryan looked toward the cleft. He saw no movement, but he knew the narrow gorge was clogged with the survivors of the last assault and the walking wounded.
Listen to me, you dumb shits! Listen to reason! There's no escape! I have more men than you can ever kill!
Bullshit. I bet he's out of grins, or down to his last one.
I can blow you out of there, but let's end this now. The Outlander Cawdor knows what I want. All he has to do is give it to me, and this is over. You have my word.
Go fuck yourself!
Do you all want to die? All your women, your children? You want your houses burned, your animals slaughtered, your crops stomped flat? Is that what you want? Because if that's what you fuckers want, we'll give it to you.
The shots all went wild.
No quarter. Good. That's just the way I want it.
Ryan, even if he's out of grins, he still holds the pass. We're still boxed in.
Not as boxed in as he's about to be.
Rising, Ryan and his friends conducted a quick inspection of the fortifications, Autry shuffling along behind them. Of the 36 defenders, only 11 remained on their feet. More than a dozen were injured so severely that they could only lie on the ground, struggling to stay conscious. Making a quick head count, Ryan counted at least 19 cadre casualties, both in and outside the perimeter. He could only guess at how many wounded were within the pass.
Autry, when I get over the wall, I want you to pin down the cadre inside the pass. Shoot at them, throw rocks, anything to stop them from coming through it again.
Get over the wall? Where are you going?
Christy, make sure to give me covering fire.
I'll tell the others.
Ryan turned toward the barricade. He bolted out into the open and sprinted toward the foot of the right side hill. A couple of musket balls plucked at his clothes, but he kept running. His companion's covering fire would keep the onslaught to a minimum. His eye was fixed on the powder-impregnated fuse that stretched down from the top of the hill. But even as he looked at it, the length of line suddenly quivered, was drawn upward in a jerky fashion, then came flying back down, looping and coiling. Ryan grimaced and scrambled up the slope, grabbing at rocks and tufts of grass. When he reached the crest, he flung himself to where the jugs of gunpowder were cached. Then he rocked to such a sudden halt, his feet nearly went out from under him. A huge man stood spraddle-legged over the containers of powder, slapping the blade of his hatchet into an open palm.
Ha! Motherfucker!